to 12. 1. Taylor Briggs had once told Judith that he measured out his life in summers. When his span came to an end, he said, it would be the summers, he remembered, and, counting them, count himself blessed among them. From the romances of his youth to the days of the last great orgies in the back rooms and bathhouses of New York and San Francisco, he could recall his career in love by sniffing the sweat from his armpits. Judith had envied him at the time. Like Gentle, she had difficulty remembering more than 10 years of her past. She had no recollection of her adolescence whatsoever, nor her childhood, could not picture her parents, or even name them. This inability to hold on to history didn't much concern her. She knew no other, until she encountered somebody like Taylor, who took such satisfaction from memory. She hoped he still did. It was one of the few pleasures left to him. She'd first heard news of his sickness the previous July, from his lover, Clem. Despite the fact that he and Taylor had lived the same high life together, the plague had passed Clem by, and Jude had spent several nights with him, talking through the guilt he felt at what he saw as an undeserved escape. Their paths had diverged through the autumn months, however, and she was surprised to find an invitation to their Christmas party awaiting her when she got back from New York. Still feeling delicate after all that had happened, she'd rung up to decline, only to have Clem quietly tell her that Taylor was not expected to see another spring, never mind another summer. Would she not come, for his sake? She, of course, accepted. If any of her circle could make good times of bad, it was Taylor and Clem, and she owed them both her best efforts in that endeavour. Was it perhaps because she'd had so many difficulties with the heterosexual males in her life that she relaxed in the company of men for whom her sex were not contested terrain? At a little after 8 in the evening of Christmas Day, Clem opened the door and ushered her in, claiming a kiss beneath the sprig of mistletoe in the hallway before, as he put it, the barbarians were upon her. The house had been decorated as it might have been a century earlier, tinsel, fake snow and fairy lights forsaken in favour of evergreen hung in such abundance around the walls and mantelpieces that the rooms were half forested. Clem, whose youth had outrun the toll of years for so long, was not such a healthy sight. 5 months before he'd looked a fleshy 30 in a flattering light, now he looked 10 years older at least, his bright welcome and flattery unable to conceal his fatigue.
"You wore green," he said as he escorted her into the lounge. "I told Taylor you'd do that. Green eyes, green dress. Do you approve?" "Of course! We're having a pagan Christmas this year. Dies Natalis Solis Invictus."
"What's that?"
"The birth of the unconquered sun," he said. "The light of the world. We need a little of that right now."
"Do I know many people here?" she said, before they stepped into the hub of the party.
"Everybody knows you, darling," he said fondly, "even the people who've never met you."
There were many faces she knew awaiting them, and it took her 5 minutes to get across to where Taylor was sitting, lord of all he surveyed, in a well-cushioned chair close to the roaring fire. She tried not to register the shock she felt at the sight of him. He'd lost almost all of what had once been a leonine head of hair, and every spare ounce of substance from the face beneath. His eyes, which had always been his most penetrating feature, one of the many things they'd had in common, seemed enormous now, as though to devour in the time he had left the sights his demise would deny him. He opened his arms to her.
"Oh, my sweet," he said, "give me a hug. Excuse me if I don't get up."
She bent and hugged him. He was skin and bone, and cold, despite the fire close by.
"Has Clem got you some punch?" "I'm on my way," Clem said. "Get me another vodka while you're at it," Taylor said, imperious as ever. "I thought we'd agreed," Clem said. "I know it's bad for me, but staying sober's worse." "It's your funeral," Clem said, with a bluntness Jude found shocking. But he and Taylor eyed each other with a kind of adoring ferocity, and she saw in the look how Clem's cruelty was part of their mechanism for dealing with this tragedy. "You wish," Taylor said. "I'll have an orange juice. Now make that a Virgin Mary. Let's be seasonal about it."
"I thought you were having a pagan celebration,"
Jude said, as Clem headed away to fetch the drinks.
"I don't see why the Christians should have the Holy Mother," Taylor said. "They don't know what to do with her when they've got her. Pull up a chair, sweetie. I heard a rumour you were in foreign climes."
"I was. But I came back at the last minute. I had some problems in New York."
"Whose heart did you break this time?"
"It wasn't that kind of problem."
"Well," he said, "be a telltale. Tell Taylor."
This was a bad joke from way back, but it brought a smile to Judith's lips. It also brought the story, which had come here swearing she'd keep to herself.
"Somebody tried to murder me," she said. "You're jesting," he replied.
"I wish I was."
"What happened?" he said. "Spill the beans. I like hearing other people's bad news just at the moment. The worse, the better."
She slid her palm over Taylor's bony hand.
"Tell me how you are first." "Grotesque," he said. "Clem's wonderful, of course, but all the tender, loving care in the world won't make me healthy. I have bad days and good days, mostly bad lately. I am, as my ma used to say, not long for this world."
He glanced up.
"Look out. Here comes St. Clements of the Bedpan. Change the subject. Clem, did Judy tell you somebody tried to kill her?"
"No. Where was this?"
"In Manhattan."
"A mugger?"
"No."
"Not someone you knew," Taylor said.
Now she was on the point of telling the whole thing, and she wasn't sure she wanted to. But Taylor had an anticipatory gleam in his eye, and she couldn't bear to disappoint him. She began, her account punctuated by exclamations of delighted incredulity from Taylor, and she found herself rising to her audience as though this story were not the grim truth, but a preposterous fiction. Only once did she lose her momentum when she mentioned Gentle's name, and Clem broke in to say that he'd been invited tonight. Her heart tripped and took a beat to get back into its rhythm.
"Tell the rest," Taylor was exhorting her. "What happened?"
She went on with her story, but now, with her back to the door, she found herself wondering every moment if he was stepping through it. Her distraction took its toll on the narrative, but then perhaps a tale about murder told by the prey was bound to predictability. She wrapped it up with undue haste.
"The point is, I'm alive," she said.
"I'll drink to that,"
Taylor replied, passing his unsipped Virgin Mary back to Clem.
"Maybe just a splash of vodka," he pleaded. "I'll take the consequences."
Clem made a reluctant shrug and, claiming Jude's empty glass, wended his way back through the crowd to the drinks table, giving Jude an excuse for turning around and scanning the room. Half a dozen new faces had appeared since she'd sat down. Gentle was not among them.
"Looking for Mr. Wright," Taylor said. "He's not here yet."
She looked back to meet his amusement.
"I don't know what you're talking about," she said.
"Mr. Zacharias."
"What's so funny?"
"You and him. The most talked about affair of the last decade. You know, when you mention him, your voice changes. It gets venomous, breathy, yearning."
"I don't yearn for Gentle."
"My mistake," he said archly.
"Was he good in bed?"
"I've had better."
"You want to know something I never told anybody?"
He leaned forward, the smile becoming more pained. She thought it was his aching body that brought the frown to his brow, until she heard his words.
"I was in love with Gentle from the moment I met him. I tried everything to get him into bed. Got him drunk, got him high. Nothing worked, but I kept at him. And about 6 years ago..."
Clem appeared at this juncture, supplying Taylor and Jude with replenished glasses before heading off to welcome a fresh influx of guests.
"You slept with Gentle,"
Jude said.
"Not exactly. I mean, I sort of talked him into letting me give him a blowjob. He was very high, grinning that grin of his. I used to worship that grin. So there I am,"
Taylor went on, as lascivious as he'd ever been when recounting his conquests,
"trying to get him hard, and he starts. I don't know how to explain this. I suppose he began speaking in tongues. He was lying back on my bed, with his trousers around his ankles, and he just started to talk in some other language. Nothing vaguely recognisable. It wasn't Spanish. It wasn't French. I don't know what it was. And you know what? I lost my hard-on, and he got one.
He laughed uproariously, but not for long. The laugh went from his face as he began again.
You know, I was a little afraid of him suddenly. I was actually afraid. I couldn't finish what I'd started. I got up and left him to it, lying there with his dick sticking up, speaking in tongues.
He claimed her drink from her hand and took a throatful. The memory had clearly shaken him. There was a mottled rash on his neck, and his eyes were glistening.
Did you ever hear anything like that from him?
She shook her head.
I only ask because I know you broke up very quickly. I wondered if he'd freaked you out for some reason. No, he just fucked around too much.
Taylor made a non-committal grunt, then said,
I get these night sweats now, you know, but I have to get up sometimes at 3 in the morning and let Clem change the sheets. I don't know whether I'm awake or asleep half the time. And all kinds of memories are coming back to me. Things I haven't thought about in years. One of them was that. I can hear him when I'm standing there in a pool of sweat. Hear him talking like he's possessed. And you don't like it? I don't know, he said. Memories mean different things to me now. I dream about my mother. And it's like I want to crawl back into her and be born all over again. I dream about Gentle, and I wonder why I let all these mysteries in my life go. Things it's too late to solve now. Being in love, speaking in tongues, it's all one in the end. I haven't understood any of it.
He shook his head and shook down tears at the same time.
I'm sorry, he said. I always get maudlin at Christmas. Will you fetch Clem for me? I need the bathroom.
Can't I help?
There's some things I still need Clem for. Thanks, anyway.
No problem.
And for listening.
She threaded her way to where Clem was chatting and discreetly informed him of Taylor's request.
You know Simone, don't you?
Clem said by way of an exit, and left Jude to talk. She did indeed know Simone, though not well. And after the conversation she'd just had with Taylor, she found it difficult to whip up a social souffle. But Simone was almost flirtatiously excessive in her responses, unleashing a gurgling laugh at the merest hint of a cue, and fingering her neck as though to mark the places she wanted kissed. Jude was silently rehearsing a polite refusal when she caught Simone's glance, ill-concealed in a particularly extravagant laugh, flitting towards somebody elsewhere in the crowd. Irritated to be cast as a stooge for the woman's vamping, she said,
Who is he?
Who's who?
Simone said, flustered and blushing.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just some man who keeps staring at me.
Her gaze went back to her admirer, and as it did so, Jude was seized by the utter certainty that if she were to turn now it would be Gentle's stare she intercepted. He was here, and up to his stale old tricks, threading himself a little string of gazes, ready to pluck the prettiest when he tired of the game.
Why don't you just go near and talk to him? She said.
I don't know if I should.
You can always change your mind if a better offer comes along.
Maybe I will,
Simone said, and without making any further attempt at conversation, she took her laugh elsewhere. Jude fought the temptation to follow her progress for fully 2 seconds, then glanced around. Simone's wooer was standing beside the Christmas tree, smiling a welcome at his object of desire as she breasted her way through the crowd towards him. It wasn't Gentle, after all, but a man she thought she remembered as Taylor's brother. Oddly relieved and irritated at herself for being so, she headed towards the drinks table for a refill, then wandered out into the hallway in search of some cooler air. There was a cellist on the half-landing, playing In the Bleak Midwinter, the melody and the instrument it was being played upon combining to melancholy effect. The front door stood open, and the air through it raised goosebumps. She went to close it, only to have one of the other listeners discreetly whisper, "There's somebody being sick out there." She glanced into the street. There was indeed somebody sitting on the edge of the pavement, in the posture of one resigned to the dictates of his belly, head down, elbows on his knees, waiting for the next surge. Perhaps she made a sound. Perhaps he simply felt her gaze on him. He raised his head and looked around.
"Gentle, what are you doing out here?"
"What does it look like?"
He hadn't looked too pretty last time she'd seen him, but he looked a damn sight worse now. Haggard, unshaven, and waxy with nausea.
"There's a bathroom in the house."
"There's a wheelchair up there," Gentle said with an almost superstitious look. "I prefer to be sick out here."
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. It was virtually covered in paint. So was the other, she now saw, and his trousers, and his shirt.
"You've been busy."
He misunderstood.
"I shouldn't have drunk anything," he said.
"Do you want me to get you some water?"
"No, thanks. I'm going home. Will you say goodbye to Taylor and Clem for me? I can't face going back in. I'll disgrace myself."
He got to his feet, stumbling a little.
"We don't seem to meet under very pleasant circumstances, do we?" he said.
"I think I should drive you home. You'll either kill yourself or somebody else."
"It's all right," he said, raising his painted hands. "The roads are empty. I'll be fine."
He started to rummage in his pocket for his car keys.
"You saved my life. Let me return the favour."
He looked up at her, his eyelids drooping.
"Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea."
She went back inside to say farewell on behalf of herself and Gentle. Taylor was back in his chair. She caught sight of him before he saw her. He was staring into middle distance, his eyes glazed. It wasn't sorrow, she read in his expression, but a fatigue so profound it had wiped all feeling from him, except, maybe, regret for unsolved mysteries. She went to him and explained that she'd found Gentle and that he was sick and needed taking home.
"Isn't he going to come and say goodbye?" Taylor said. "I think he's afraid of throwing up all over the carpet, or you, or both."
"Tell him to call me. Tell him I want to see him soon."
He took hold of Jude's hand, holding it with surprising strength.
"Soon. Tell him."
"I will."
"I want to see that grin of his one more time."
"There'll be lots of times," she said.
He shook his head.
"Once we'll have to do,"
he replied softly. She kissed him and promised she'd call to say she got home safely. On her way to the door, she met Clem and once again made her apologies and farewells.
"Call me if there's anything I can do," she offered.
"Thanks, but I think it's a waiting game."
"Then we can wait together."
"Better just him and me," Clem said.
"But I will call."
He glanced towards Taylor, who was once more staring at nothing.
"He's determined to hold on till spring. One more spring, he keeps saying. He never gave a fuck about crocuses till now."
Clem smiled.
"You know what's wonderful," he said. "I've fallen in love with him all over again."
"That is wonderful."
"And now I'm going to lose him, just when I realize what he means to me." "You won't make that mistake, will you?"
He looked at her hard.
"You know who I mean."
She nodded.
"Good, then you'd better take him home."
2. The roads were as empty as he'd predicted, and it took only 15 minutes to get back to Gentle's studio. He wasn't exactly coherent. On the way, the exchanges between them were full of gaps and discontinuities, as though his mind were running ahead of his tongue, or behind it. Drink wasn't the culprit. Jude had seen Gentle drunk on all forms of alcohol. It made him roaring, randy, and sanctimonious by turns. Never like this, with his head back against the seat, his eyes closed, talking from the bottom of a pit. One moment he was thanking her for looking after him. The next he was telling her not to mistake the paint on his hands for shit, It wasn't shit, he kept saying. It was burnt umber, and Prussian blue, and cadmium yellow. But somehow when you mixed colours together, any colours, they always came out looking like shit eventually. This monologue dwindled into silence, from which, a minute or two later, a new subject emerged.
I can't look at him, you know, the way he is.
Who? Jude said.
Taylor. I can't look at him when he's so sick. You know how much I hate sickness.
She'd forgotten. It amounted to a paranoia with him, fueled perhaps by the fact that though he treated his body with scant regard for its health, he not only never sickened but hardly aged. Doubtless the collapse, when it came, would be calamitous, excess, frenzy, and the passage of years taking their toll in one fell swoop. Until that time, he wanted no reminders of his physical frailty.
Taylor's going to die, isn't he? He said.
Clem thinks very soon.
Gentle gave a heavy sigh.
I shall spend some time with him. We were good friends once.
There were rumours about you two.
He spread them, not me.
Just rumours, were they?
What do you think?
I think you've probably tried every experience that swam by at least once.
He's not my type, Gentle said,
not opening his eyes.
You should see him again, she said. You've got to face up to falling apart sooner or later. It happens to us all.
Not to me, it won't. When I start to decay, I'm going to kill myself. I swear.
He made fists of his painted hands and raised them to his face, drawing the knuckles down over his cheeks.
I won't let it happen, he said.
Good luck, she replied.
They drove the rest of the way without any further exchange between them, his passive presence on the passenger seat beside her making her uneasy. She kept thinking of Taylor's story and expecting him to start talking, unleashing a stream of lunacies. It wasn't until she announced that they'd arrived at the studio that she realized he'd fallen asleep. She stared at him a while, at the smooth dome of his forehead and the delicate configuration of his lips. It was still in her to dote on him, no question of that. But what lay that way? Disappointment and frustrated rage. Despite Clem's words of encouragement, she was almost certain it was a lost cause. She shook him awake and asked him if she could use his bathroom before going on her way. The punch was heavy in her bladder. He was hesitant, which surprised her. The suspicion dawned that he'd already moved a female companion into the studio, some seasonal bird to be stuffed for Christmas and dumped by New Year. Curiosity made her press to be allowed in. Reluctant as he was, he could scarcely say no, of course, and she traipsed up the stairs after him, wondering as she went what the conquest was going to look like, only to find that the studio was empty. His sole companion was the painting that had so filthied his hands. He seemed genuinely upset that she'd set eyes on it and ushered her to the bathroom, more discomforted than if her first suspicions had been correct and one of his conquests had indeed been disporting herself on the threadbare couch. Poor Gentle. It was getting stranger by the day. She relieved herself and emerged from the toilet to find the painting covered with a stained sheet and him looking furtive and fidgety, clearly eager to have her out of the place. She saw no reason not to be plain with him and said,
"Working on something new?"
"Nothing much," he said.
"I'd like to see."
"It's not finished."
"It doesn't matter to me if it's a fake," she said. "I know what you and Klein get up to."
"It's not a fake," he said,
a fierceness in his voice and face she'd not seen so far tonight.
"It's mine."
"An original Zacharias," she remarked. "This I have to see."
She reached for the sheet before he could stop her and flipped it up over the top of the canvas. She'd only had a glimpse of the picture as she'd entered and from some distance. Up close, it was clear he'd worked on the canvas with no little ferocity. There were places where it had been punctured, as though he'd stabbed it with his palette knife or brush, other places where the paint was laid on with glutinous abandon, then thumbed and fingered to drive it before his will. All this to achieve the likeness of what? Two people, it seemed, standing face to face against a brutal sky, their flesh white but shot through with jabs of livid colour.
Who are they? She said.
They?
He said, sounding almost surprised that she'd read the image thusly, then covering his response with a shrug.
Nobody,
he said. Just an experiment, and pulled the sheet back down over the painting.
Is it a commission?
I prefer not to discuss it, he said. His discomfort was oddly charming. He was like a child who'd been caught about some secret ritual.
You're full of surprises, she said, smiling.
Nah, not me.
Though the painting was out of sight, he continued to look ill at ease, and she realized there was going to be no further discussion of the picture or its import.
I'll be off then, she said.
Thanks for the lift,
he replied, escorting her to the door.
Do you still want to have that drink? She said.
You're not going back to New York?
Not immediately. I'll call you in a couple of days. Don't forget Taylor.
What are you? My conscience, he said, with too small a trace of humour to soften the weight of the reply. I won't forget.
You leave marks on people, Gentle. That's a responsibility you can't just shrug off.
I'll try to be invisible from now on, he replied.
He didn't take her to the front door, but let her head down the stairs alone, closing the studio door before she'd taken more than half a dozen steps. As she went, she wondered what misbegotten instinct had made her suggest drinks. Well, it was easily slipped out of, even assuming he remembered the suggestion had been made, which she doubted. Once out in the street, she looked up at the building to see if she could spot him through the window. She had to cross the road to do so, but from the opposite pavement she could see him standing in front of the painting, which he had once again unveiled. He was staring at it with his head slightly cocked. She couldn't be certain, but it looked as though his lips were moving, as though he were talking to the image on the canvas. What was he saying? She wondered. Was he coaxing some image forth from the chaos of paint? And if so, in which of his many tongues was he speaking? Chapter 13. 1. She had seen two people where he'd painted one. Not a he, a she, or an it, but they. She'd looked at the image and seen past his conscious intention to a buried purpose, one he'd hidden even from himself. Now he went back to the canvas and looked at it again, with borrowed eyes, and there they were, the two she'd seen. In his passion to capture some impression of Pi O Pa, he had painted the assassin stepping from shadow, or back into it, a stream of darkness running down the middle of his face and torso. It divided the figure from top to bottom, and its outer edges, ragged and lush, described the reciprocative forms of profiles, etched in white from the halves of what he'd intended to be a single face. They stared at each other like lovers, eyes looking forward in the Egyptian manner, the backs of their heads folded into shadow. The question was, who were these two? What had he been trying to express, setting these faces thus, nose to nose? He interrogated the painting for several minutes after she'd gone, preparing as he did so to attack the canvas again, but when it came to doing so, he lacked the strength. His hands were trembling, his palms clammy. His eyes could only focus upon the image indifferently well. He retreated from the picture, afraid to touch it in this weakened state, for fear he'd undo what little he'd already achieved. A painting could escape so quickly. A few inept strokes and a likeness to a face, to another painter's work, could flee the canvas and never be recaptured. Better to leave it alone tonight, to rest, and hope he was strong tomorrow. He dreamed of sickness, of lying in his bed, naked beneath a thin white sheet, shivering so hard his teeth chattered. Snow fell from the ceiling intermittently and didn't melt when it touched his flesh, because he was colder than the snow. There were visitors in his sick room, and he tried to tell them how cold he was, but he had no power in his voice, and the words came out as gasps, as though he were struggling for his last breath. He began to fear that this dream condition was fatal, that snow and breathlessness would bury him. He had to act, rise up from the hard bed and prove these mourners premature. With painful slowness, he moved his hands to the edge of the mattress in the hope of pulling himself upright, but the sheets were slick with his final sweat and he couldn't get a firm hold. Fear turned to panic, despair bringing on a new round of gasps, more desperate than the last. He struggled to make his situation plain, but the door of his sick room stood wide now, and all the mourners had disappeared through it. He could hear them in another room, talking and laughing. There was a patch of sun on the threshold, he saw. Next door it was summer. Here there was only the heart-stopping cold, taking a firmer grip on him by the moment. He gave up attempting Lazarus and instead let his palms lie flat on the sheets and his eyes flutter closed. The sound of voices from the next room softened to a murmur. The noise of his heart dwindled. New sounds rose to replace it, however. A wind was gusting outside and branches thrashed at the windows. Somebody's voice rose in prayer. Another simply sobbed. What grief was this? Not his passing, surely. He was too minor to earn such lamentation. He opened his eyes again. The bed had gone. So had the snow. Lightning threw into silhouette a man who stood watching the storm.
"Can you make me forget?" Gentle heard himself saying. "Do you have the trick of that?"
"Of course," came the soft reply. "But you don't want it."
"No, what I want's death. But I'm too afraid of that tonight. That's the real sickness, fear of death. But I can live with forgetfulness. Give me that."
"For how long?"
"Until the end of the world."
Another lightning flash burned out the figure in front of him, and then the whole scene. Gone. Forgotten. Gentle blinked the afterimage of window and silhouette out of his eyes, and in doing so passed between sleep and waking. The room was cold, but not as icy as his deathbed. He sat upright, staring first at his unclean hands, then at the window. It was still night, but he could hear the sound of vehicles on the Edgware Road, their murmur reassuring. Already, distracted by sound and sight, the nightmare was fading. He was happy to lose it. He shrugged off the bedclothes and went to the kitchen to find himself something to drink. There was a carton of milk in the refrigerator. He downed its contents, though the milk was ready to turn, aware that his churned system would probably reject it in short order. Quenched, he wiped his mouth and chin and went through to look at the painting again, but the intensity of the dream from which he'd just woken made a mockery of his efforts. He would not conjure the assassin by this crude magic. He could paint a dozen canvases, 100, and still not capture the ambiguities of Pi-O-Pa. He belched, bringing the taste of bad milk back up into his mouth. What was he to do? Lock himself away and let this sickness in him, put there by the sight of the assassin, consume him? Or bathe, sweeten himself, and go out to find some faces to put between him and the memory? Both vain endeavours, which left a third distressing route, to find Pi-O-Pa in the flesh, to face him, question him, have his fill of him, until every ambiguity was scarred away. He went on, staring at the painting while he turned this option over. What would it take to find the assassin? An interrogation of Esterbrook, for one. That wouldn't be too onerous a duty. Then a search of the city, to find the place Esterbrook had claimed he couldn't recall. Again, no great hardship. Better than sour milk and sourer dreams. Knowing that in the light of morning he might lose his present clarity of mind, and he was best to close off at least one route of retreat, he went to the paints, squeezed onto his palm a fat worm of cadmium yellow, and worked it into the still wet canvas. It obliterated the lovers immediately, but he wasn't satisfied until he'd covered the canvas from edge to edge. The colour fought for its brilliance, but it soon deteriorated, tainted by the darkness it was trying to obscure. By the time he'd finished, it was as if his attempt to capture Pi-O-Pa had never been made. Satisfied, he stood back and belched again. The nausea had gone from him. He felt strangely buoyant. Maybe sour milk suited him. 2. Pai O Pa sat on the step of his trailer and stared up at the night sky. In their beds behind him, his adopted wife and children slept. In the heavens above him, the stars were burning behind a blanket of sodium-tinted cloud. He had seldom felt more alone in his long life than now. Since returning from New York, he had been in a state of constant anticipation. Something was going to happen to him and his world, but he didn't know what. His ignorance pained him, not simply because he was helpless in the face of this imminent event, but because his inability to grasp its nature was testament to how his skills had deteriorated. The days when he could read futurities off the air had gone. He was more and more a prisoner of the here and now. That here, the body he occupied, was also less than its former glory. It was so long since he'd corresponded the way he had with Gentle, taking the will of another as the gospel of his flesh, that he'd almost lost the trick of it. But Gentle's desire had been potent enough to remind him, and his body still reverberated with echoes of their time together. Though it had ended badly, he didn't regret snatching those minutes. Another such encounter might never come. He wandered from his trailer towards the perimeter of the encampment. The first light of dawn was beginning to eat at the murk. One of the camp mongrels, back from a night of adventuring, squeezed between two sheets of corrugated iron and came wagging to his side. He stroked the dog's snout and tickled behind its battle-ravaged ears, wishing he could find his way back to his home and master so easily. 3. It was the oft-stated belief of Esmond Bloom Godolphin, the late father of Oscar and Charles, that a man could never have too many bolt-holes. And of EBG's countless sores, this was the only one Oscar had been significantly influenced by. He had not less than 4 places of occupation in London. The house in Primrose Hill was his chief residence, but there was also a pied-à-terre in Maida Vale, a smallish flat in Notting Hill, and the location he was presently occupying, a windowless warehouse concealed in a maze of derelict and near-derelict properties near the river. It was not a place he was particularly happy to frequent, especially not on the day after Christmas, but over the years it had proved a secure haven for Dowd's 2 associates, the Voiders, and it now served as a chapel of rest for Dowd himself. His naked corpse lay beneath a shroud on the cold concrete, with aromatic herbs picked and dried on the slopes of the Jokalelau, smouldering in bowls at his head and feet, after the rituals proscribed in that region. The Voiders had shown little interest in the arrival of their leader's body. They were functionaries, incapable of anything but the most rudimentary thought processes. They had no physical appetites, no desire, no hunger or thirst, no ambition. They simply sat out the days and nights in the darkness of the warehouse and waited for Dowd to instruct them. Oscar was less than comfortable in their company, but could not bring himself to leave until this business was finished. He'd brought a book to read, a cricket almanac that he found soothing to peruse. Every now and then he'd get up and refuel the bowls, otherwise there was little to do but wait. It had already been a day and a half since he'd made such a show of taking Dowd's life, a performance of which he was justly proud, but the casualty that lay before him was a real loss. Dowd had been passed down the line of Godolphins for 2 centuries, bound to them until the end of time, or of Joshua's line, whichever came first. And he had been a fine manservant. Who else could mix a whiskey and soda so well? Who else knew to dry and powder between Oscar's toes with special care, because he was prone to fungal infections there? Dowd was irreplaceable, and it had pained Oscar considerably to take the brutal measures circumstance had demanded. But he'd done so knowing that while there was a slim possibility that he would lose his servant forever, an entity such as Dowd could survive a disemboweling as long as the rituals of resurrection were readily and precisely followed. Oscar was not in ignorance of those rituals. He'd spent many lazy Isordorexian evenings on the roof of Peckable's house, watching the tail of the comet disappear behind the towers of the Autarch's palace, talking about the theory and practice of immagical fates, writs, pneumas, Eurydos, and the rest. He knew the oils to pour into Dowd's carcass, and what blossoms to burn around the body. He even had in his treasure room a phonetic version of the ritual set down by Peckable himself, in case Dowd was ever harmed. He had no idea how long the process would take, but he knew better than to peer beneath the sheet to see if the bread of life was rising. He could only bide his time and hope he'd done all that was necessary. At 4:04, he had proof of his precision. A choking breath was drawn beneath the sheet, and a second later Dowd sat up. The motion was so sudden, and after such a time so unexpected, Oscar panicked, his chair tipping over as he rose, the almanac flying from his hand. He'd seen much in his time that the people of the Fifth would call miraculous, but not in a dismal room like this, with the commonplace world grinding on its way outside the door. Composing himself, he searched for a word of welcome, but his mouth was so dry he could have blotted a letter with his tongue. He simply stared, gaping and amazed. Dowd had pulled the sheet off his face and was studying the hand with which he'd done so, his face as empty as the eyes of the voiders sitting against the opposite wall. "I've made a terrible error," Oscar thought. "I brought back the body, but the soul's gone out of him. Oh, Christ, what now?" Dowd stared on blankly. Then, like a puppet into which a hand has been inserted, bringing the illusion of life and independent purpose to senseless stuff, he raised his head and his face filled with expression. It was all anger. He narrowed his eyes and bared his teeth as he spoke.
"You did me a great wrong," he said. "A terrible wrong."
Oscar worked up some spittle, thick as mud.
"I did what I deemed necessary," he replied, determined not to be cowed by the creature.
It had been bound by Joshua never to do a Godolphin harm, much as it might presently wish to.
"What have I ever done to you that you humiliate me that way?" Dowd said.
"I had to prove my allegiance to the tabula rasa. You understand why."
"And must I continue to be humiliated?" he said. "Can I not at least have something to wear?"
"Your suit's stained."
"It's better than nothing," Dowd replied.
The garments lay on the floor a few feet from where Dowd sat, but he made no move to pick them up. Aware that Dowd was testing the limits of his master's remorse, but willing to play the game for a while at least, Oscar picked up the clothes and laid them within Dowd's reach.
"I knew a knife wasn't going to kill you," he said.
"It's more than I did," Dowd replied. "But that's not the point. I would have entered the game with you if that's what you'd wanted. Happily, slavishly, entered and died for you."
His tone was that of a man deeply and inconsolably affronted.
"Instead, you conspire against me. You make me suffer like a common criminal."
"I couldn't afford for it to look like a charade. If they'd suspected it was stage-managed..."
"Oh, I see,"
Dowd replied. Unwittingly, Oscar had caused even greater offence with this justification.
"You didn't trust my actorly instincts. I've played every lead Quexos wrote. Comedy, tragedy, farce. And you didn't trust me to carry off a petty little death scene? All right, I was mistaken. I thought the knife stung badly enough, but this..."
"Please accept my apologies. It was crude and hurtful. What can I do to heal the harm, eh? Name it, Dowdy. I feel I violated the trust between us and I have to make good. Whatever you want, just name it."
Dowd shook his head.
"It's not as easy as that."
"I know, but it's a start. Name it."
Dowd considered the offer for a full minute, staring not at Oscar, but the blank wall. Finally, he said,
"I'll start with the assassin, Pi O'Par."
"What do you want with a mischief?"
"I want to torment it. I want to humiliate it. And finally, I want to kill it."
"Why?"
"You offered me whatever I wanted. Name it, you said. I've named it."
"Then you have carte blanche to do whatever you wish," Oscar said. "Is that all?"
"For now," Dowd said. "I'm sure something more will occur."
Death's put some strange ideas in my head, but I'll name them as time goes by.
Chapter 14 1 While it was to prove difficult for Gentle to prize from Esterbrook the details of the night journey that had taken him to Pai O'Pa, it was not as difficult as getting in to see the man in the first place. He went to the house around noon to find the curtains at all the windows meticulously drawn. He knocked and rang the bell for several minutes, but there was no reply. Assuming Esterbrook had gone out for a constitutional, he left off his attempt and went to find something to put into his stomach, which, after being so thoroughly scorned the night before, was echoing with its own emptiness. It was Boxing Day, of course, and there was no cafe or restaurant open, but he located a small supermarket managed by a family of Pakistanis, who were doing a fine trade supplying Christians with stale bread to break. Though the stock had disappeared from many of the shelves, the store still had a tempting parade of tooth decayers, and Gentle left with chocolate, biscuits, and cake to satisfy his sweet tooth. He found a bench and sat down to subdue his hunger. The cake was too moist and heavy for his taste, so he broke it up into pieces and threw it to the pigeons his meal had attracted. The news soon spread that there was sustenance to be had, and what had been an intimate picnic quickly turned into a squabbling match. In lieu of loaves and fishes to subdue the mob, Gentle tossed the rest of his biscuits into the midst of the feasters and returned to Esterbrook's house, content with his chocolate. As he approached, he saw a motion at one of the upper windows. He didn't bother to ring and knock this time, but simply called up at the window.
"I want a word, Charlie. I know you're in there. Open up."
When there was no sign of Esterbrook obliging, he let his voice ring out a little louder. There was very little competition from traffic, this being a holiday. His call was a clarion.
"Come on, Charlie! Open up! Unless you want me to tell the neighbours about our little deal."
The curtain was drawn aside this time, and Gentle had his first sight of Esterbrook. A glimpse, only, for the curtain was dropped back into place a moment later. Gentle waited, and just as he was about to start his haranguing afresh, heard the front door being unbolted. Esterbrook appeared, barefoot and bald. The latter was a shock. Gentle hadn't known the man wore a toupee. Without it, his face was as round and white as a plate, his features set upon it like a child's breakfast. Eggs for eyes, a tomato nose, sausage lips, all swimming in a grease of fear.
"It's time we talked," Gentle said, and without waiting for an invitation, stepped inside.
He pulled no punches in his interrogation, making it plain from the outset that this was no social call. He needed to know where to find Pai O'Pa, and he wasn't going to be fobbed off with excuses. To aid Esterbrook's memory, he'd brought a battered street map of London. He set it down on the table between them.
"Now," he said, "we sit here until you've told me where you went that night, and if you lie to me, I swear I'm going to come back and break your neck."
Esterbrook didn't attempt any obfuscation. His manner was that of a man who had passed many days in terror of a sound upon his step, and was relieved, now that it had come, that his caller was merely human. His egg eyes were perpetually on the verge of breaking, and his hands trembled as he flipped the pages of the Gazetteer, murmuring as he did so that he was sure of nothing, but he would try to remember. Gentle didn't press too hard, but let the man make the journey again in memory, running his finger back and forth over the map as he did so. They'd driven through Lambeth, he said, then Kennington and Stockwell. He didn't remember grazing Clapham Common, so he assumed they'd driven to the east of it, towards Streatham Hill. He remembered a church, and sought out a cross on the map that would mark the place. There were several, but only one close to the other landmark he remembered, the railway line. At this point he said he could offer nothing more by way of directions, only a description of the place itself, the corrugated iron perimeter, the trailers, the fires.
"You'll find it," he said.
"I'd better," Gentle replied.
He'd so far told Esterbrook nothing about the circumstances that had brought him back here, though the man had several times asked if Judith was alive and well. Now he asked again.
"Please tell me," he said. "I've been straight with you, I swear I have. Won't you please tell me how she is?"
"She's alive and kicking," Gentle said.
Has she mentioned me at all? She must have done. What did she say? Did you tell her I still love her?
I'm not your pimp, Gentle said. Tell her yourself, if you can get her to talk to you.
What am I going to do? Estabrook said. He took hold of Gentle's arm. You're an expert with women, aren't you? Everybody says so. What can I do to make amends?
She'd probably be satisfied if you sent her your balls, Gentle said. Anything less wouldn't be appropriate.
You think it's funny?
Trying to have your wife killed? No, I don't think that's very amusing. Changing your mind and wanting everything lovey-dovey again, that's hysterical.
You wait till you love somebody the way I love Judith. If you're capable of that, which I doubt, you wait until you want somebody so badly your sanity hangs on it. You'll learn.
Gentle didn't rise to the remark. It was too close to his present state to be fully confessed, even to himself. But once out of the house, map in hand, he couldn't suppress a smile of pleasure that he had a way forward. It was already getting gloomy as the midwinter afternoon closed its fist on the city. But darkness loved lovers, even if the world no longer did. 2. At midday, with his unease of the previous night, allayed not one jot, Pai O'Parr had suggested to Teresa that they should leave the encampment. The suggestion wasn't met with enthusiasm. The baby was sick with sniffles and had not stopped wailing since she'd woken. The other child was feverish too. This was no time to be going away, Teresa said, even if they had somewhere to go, which they didn't. We'll take the trailer with us, Pai replied. We'll just drive out of the city. To the coast, maybe, where the children would benefit from the cleaner air. Teresa liked that idea. Tomorrow, she said, or the day after, but not now. Pai pressed the case, however, until she asked him what he was so nervous about. He had no answer to give. At least none that she'd care to hear. She understood nothing of his nature, nor questioned him about his past. He was simply a provider, someone who put food in the mouths of her children and his arms around her at night. But her question still hung in the air, so he answered it as best he could.
I'm afraid for us, he said. It's that old man, isn't it? Teresa replied. The one who came to see you? Who was he? He wanted a job done.
And you did it?
No.
So you think he's going to come back? She said. We'll set the dogs on him.
It was healthy to hear such plain solutions, even if, as now, they didn't answer the problem at hand. His mischief soul was sometimes too readily drawn to the ambiguities that mirrored his true self. But she chastened him. Reminded him that he'd taken a face and a function, and, in this human sphere, a sex, that as far as she was concerned, he belonged in the fixed world of children, dogs, and orange peel. There was no room for poetry in such straitened circumstances, no time between hard dawn and uneasy dusk for the luxury of doubt or speculation. Now another of those dusks had fallen, and Teresa was putting her cherished ones to bed in the trailer. They slept well. He had a spell that he'd kept polished from the days of his power, a way of speaking prayers into a pillow so they'd sweeten the sleeper's dreams. His maestro had asked for its comfort often, and Pai used it still, 200 years later. Even now Teresa was laying her children's heads upon down suffused with cradle songs, secreted there to guide them from the dark world into the bright. The mongrel he'd met at the perimeter in the pre-dawn gloom was barking furiously, and he went out to calm it. Seeing him approach, it pulled on its chain, scrabbling at the dirt to be closer to him. Its owner was a man Pai had little contact with, a short-tempered Scot who brutalized the dog when he could catch it. Pai went down on his haunches to hush the creature, for fear its din brought the owner out from his supping. The dog obeyed, but continued to paw at Pai fretfully, clearly wanting to be loosed from its leash.
"What's wrong, Buster?" he said to it, scratching behind its war-torn ears. "Have you got a lady out there?"
He looked up towards the perimeter as he spoke and caught the fleeting glimpse of a figure stepping into shadow behind one of the trailers. The dog had seen the interloper too. It set up a new round of barking. Pai stood up again.
"Who's there?"
he demanded.
A sound at the other end of the encampment claimed his attention momentarily. Water splashing on the ground. No, not water. The stench that reached his nostrils was that of petrol. He looked back towards his own trailer. Teresa's shadow was on the blind, her head bowed as she turned off the nightlight beside the children's bed. The stench was coming from that direction, too. He reached down and released the dog.
Go, boy! Go, go!
It ran barking at a figure slipping out through a gap in the fence. As it went, Pye started towards his trailer, yelling Teresa's name. Behind him, somebody shouted for him to shut up out there, but the curses were unfinished, erased by the boom and bloom of fire, twin eruptions that lit the encampment from end to end. He heard Teresa scream, saw flame surge up and around his trailer. The spilled fuel was only a ruse. Before he'd covered 10 yards, the mother load exploded directly under the vehicle, the force sufficient to lift it off the ground and pitch it on its side. Pye was blown over by a solid wave of heat. By the time he'd scrabbled to his feet, the trailer was a solid sheet of flame. As he pitched himself through the baking air towards the pyre, he heard another sobbing cry and realized it was his own, a sound he'd forgotten his throat could make, but which was always the same, grief on grief. Gentle had just sighted the church which had been Esterbrook's last landmark, when a sudden day broke on the street ahead, as though the sun had come to burn the night away. The car in front of his veered sharply, and he was only able to prevent a collision by mounting the pavement, bringing his own car to a juddering halt inches short of the church wall. He got out and headed towards the fire on foot, turning a corner to head directly into the smoke, which veered and veered again as he ran, allowing him only glimpses of his destination. He saw a corrugated iron fence, and beyond it a host of trailers, most of which were already ablaze. Even if he'd not had Esterbrook's description to confirm that this was indeed Pye O'Parr's home, the fact of its destruction would have marked it out. Death had preceded him here, like his shadow, thrown forward by a blaze at his back that was even brighter than the one that lay ahead. His knowledge of this other cataclysm, the one behind, had been a part of the business between himself and the assassin from the beginning. It had flickered in their first exchanges on Fifth Avenue. It had lit the fury that had sent him to debate with the canvas, and it had burned brightest in his dreams in that room he'd invented, or remembered, where he'd begged Pye for forgetfulness. What had they experienced together that had been so terrible he'd wanted to forget his whole life rather than live with the fact? Whatever it was somehow echoed in this new calamity, and he wished to God he could have his forgetfulness undone, and know what crime he'd committed that brought upon innocence such punishment as this. The encampment was an inferno, wind fanning flames that in turn inspired new wind with flesh, the toy of both. He had only piss and spittle against this conflagration, useless, but he ran on towards it anyway, his eyes streaming as the smoke bit at them, not knowing what hope of survival he had, only certain that Pye was somewhere in this firestorm, and to lose him now would be tantamount to losing himself. There were some escapees, a pitiful few. He ran past them towards the gap in the fence through which they'd escaped. His route was by turns clear and confounded, as the wind brought choking smoke in his direction, then carried it away again. He pulled off his leather jacket and threw it over his head as primitive protection against the heat, then ducked through the fence. There was solid flame in front of him, making the way forward impassable. He tried to his left and found a gap between two blazing vehicles. Dodging between them, the smell of singeing leather already sharp in his nostrils, he found himself in the middle of the compound, a space relatively free of combustible material and thus of fire. But on every side the flames had hold. Only three of the trailers weren't blazing, and the veering wind would soon carry the flame in their direction. How many of the inhabitants had fled before the flames took hold he couldn't know, but it was certain there'd be no further escapees. The heat was nearly unbearable. It beat upon him from every side, cooking his thoughts to incoherence. But he held on to the image of the creature he'd come to find, determined not to desert the pyre until he had that face in his hands, or knew beyond doubt it was Ash. A dog appeared from the smoke, barking hysterically. As it ran past him, a fresh eruption of fire drove it back the way it had come, its panic escalating. Having no better route, he chased its tail through the chaos, calling Pi's name as he ran, though each breath he took was hotter than the last, and after a few such shouts the name was a rasp. He'd lost the dog in the smoke and all sense of direction at the same time. Even if the way was still clear, he no longer knew where it lay. The world was fire on every side. Somewhere up ahead he heard the dog again, and thinking now that maybe the only life he'd claim from this horror was the hound's, he ran in search of it. Tears were pouring from his smoke-stung eyes. He could barely focus on the ground he was stumbling across. The barking stopped again, leaving him without a beacon. There was no way to go but forward, hoping the silence didn't mean the dog had succumbed. It hadn't. He spotted it ahead of him now, cowering in terror. As he drew a breath to call it to him, he saw the figure beyond it, stepping from the smoke. The fire had taken its toll on Pi O'Pa, but he was at least alive. His eyes, like Gentle's, streamed. There was blood at his mouth and neck, and in his arms, a forlorn bundle. A child.
"Are there more?" Gentle yelled.
Pi's reply was to glance back over his shoulder towards a heap of debris that had once been a trailer. Rather than draw another lung-cooking breath to reply, Gentle started towards this bonfire, but was intercepted by Pi, who passed over the child in his arms.
"Take her," he said.
Gentle threw aside his jacket and took the child.
"Now get out," Pi said. "I'll follow."
He didn't wait to see his instruction obeyed, but turned back towards the debris. Gentle looked down at the child he was carrying. She was bloody and blackened, surely dead. But perhaps life could be pumped back into her if he was quick. What was the fastest route to safety? The way he'd come was blocked now, and the ground ahead littered with burning wreckage. Between left and right, he chose left, because he heard the incongruous sound of somebody whistling somewhere in the smoke, at least proof that breath could be drawn in that direction. The dog came with him, but only for a few steps. Then it retreated again, despite the fact that the air was cooler by the step, and a gap in the flames was visible ahead. Visible, but not empty. As Gentle headed for the place, a figure stepped out from behind one of the bonfires. It was the Whistler, still practicing his craft, though his hair was burning and his hands, raised in front of him, were smoking ruins. He turned his head as he walked and looked at Gentle. The tune he whistled was charmless, but it was sweet beside the stare he had. His eyes were like mirrors, reflecting the fires. They flared and smoked. This was the fire-setter, he realized, or one of them. That was why it whistled as it burned, because this was its paradise. It didn't attempt to lay its carbonized hands on either Gentle or the child, but walked on into the smoke, turning its stare back towards the blaze as it did so, leaving Gentle's route to the perimeter clear. The cooler air was heady. It dizzied him, made him stumble. He held on tight to the child, his only thought now to get it out into the street, in which endeavor he was aided by two masked firemen who'd seen his approach and came to meet him now, arms outstretched. One took the child from him, the other bore him up as his legs gave way beneath him.
"There's people alive in there," he said, looking back towards the fire. "You've got to get them out."
His rescuer didn't leave his side till he'd got Gentle through the fence and into the street. Then there were other hands to take charge. Ambulance attendants with stretchers and blankets, telling him that he was safe now and everything would be all right. But it wasn't. Not as long as Pi was in the fire. He shrugged off the blanket and refused the oxygen mask.